Okay, my name is Andy Reed. My background is that I studied history at university. A couple of years after leaving university, I decided to become a teacher and did a PGCE, as they're now called. And that was also specializing in history for secondary school teaching. I got a job firstly at a 13 to 18 comprehensive school in Wakefield. That was a very good introduction to teaching because it was an extremely tough school, which had the category existed at that time would have been in special measures almost undoubtedly, but the kids were great, mostly. And as I say, it was a good place to learn to teach. I was there for 2.5 years until December 1974 as mainly a history teacher, but I also taught English and social studies. I then applied for and got the post of head of history at a secondary modern school in Norfolk, 11 to 16 school, obviously. That school in due course became comprehensive in September 1978, changed its name, and my job changed. I was promoted to be head of humanities with responsibility for history, geography, religious education, social studies, and somewhat bizarrely music, in which I had no credentials at all but had very good colleagues. I remained there until the summer of 1985. I had a term out in the autumn term of 1984 to start an MEd, which I subsequently completed. In 1985, I was appointed as liaison officer with the Norfolk Museum Service to work with the museum service staff as a history teacher, educationalist, representative of the education department, based at Gresson Hall, or to give it its proper title, the Norfolk Rural Life Museum at Gresson Hall, which is housed in a former workhouse, 18th century house of industry, fascinating place. And I was based there for 2 years, doing work, it was a combination of research on the history of the workhouse, which I thoroughly enjoyed and resulted in the development of a lot of teaching material and in the development of a lot of GCSE assignments by Norfolk schools. Intramural teaching of school groups, but not a lot of that. My role was much more to do with empowering teachers to use the varied resources that the museum and its buildings offered, not just for history but for other areas of the curriculum. And then the third strand was outreach work, I did a lot of that, visited a lot of schools, gave talks and so forth. At the same time, I was also able to work as a GCSE trainer with the local authority. Helped to initiate something which became known as the Norfolk History Teachers Association, of which I became chair, which was really an example of bottom-up professional development for history teachers. There wasn't a history advisor, there was actually very little provision by the local authority, so we did it ourselves. To give them credit, the local authority supported us and gave us a budget, and so we were able to invite people like Kate Morse and Scott Harrison and Sally Perkis and Dennis Schemmelt, others really from across the country to come and talk to audiences of Norfolk history teachers. After 2 years based at Gresson Hall, I was then appointed as Teacher Advisor for Humanities Brackets History in 1987, and that was a role based at County Hall, working within the local authority, with the focus very much on support and development and review of history across the county. And then a year later, I was appointed as General County Inspector for History in Staffordshire, which involved actually a continuation of much of the same sort of work that I've been doing in Norfolk, together with more formal review and evaluation of mainly history, but the role had a general dimension as well, in primary and secondary schools in Staffordshire. And I was there for 3.5 years until December 1991. I then took up an appointment as Her Majesty's Inspector of Schools from January 1992, and remained an HMI until my retirement from Ofsted in when was it? December 2007. By which time I was a divisional manager within Ofsted. So that's the story of my career. After joining HMI, as it then was, this was before the creation of Ofsted, I worked as a history specialist HMI for just my first year and a half, not exclusively, because you know, HMI always were deployed on a sort of matrix work program that involved doing general work, doing a variety of exercises. But for the first year and a half, history specialist work was an important component of what I did. That ceased to be the case after the creation of Ofsted in September 1993, when I had more generic and general roles, and ultimately majored on school improvement, which became actually my main kind of passion and commitment as an HMI. So history, you know, history went into the background, but it remained an interest, and I kept in touch with people and was invited to become a fellow of the school's history project in 2005, I think it was, which I'm delighted to accept that invitation. So it's been a case of staying in touch, but, and of course we met at the SHP conference. Yes, so lovely. That brings us up to the present. Sorry, that was terribly long, Nicola. I do apologize.
That's great.
You'll have to cut me off and I get boring.
How did your ideas about teaching history develop during your years as a school teacher?
Okay. I mean, your questions were helpful. Thank you for those. And I sort of thought about this a bit in preparation for this afternoon. I mean, university history was a great experience, but I have to say not terribly relevant to the experience of teaching history in school. The PGCE course was influential mainly in introducing me to local sources, which had formed no part of what I'd done at Cambridge. I mean, that was just, you know, wasn't a dimension at all. We hardly ever looked at any primary evidence, and when we did, it certainly wasn't local. I found it utterly fascinating. So that was an initial influence. But then as a teacher, I suppose developing a more investigative approach, trying to make a reality of a more investigative approach to history teaching was a theme over the however many years it was, 13 years that I was a history teacher. And at the same time as seeking to make a reality of that, also becoming less inhibited or less apologetic, if you like, about doing whole class teaching when it was appropriate to do that, and telling stories and presenting history as a sort of prelude to investigation by by pupils. When I started, I guess my practice, like, you know, so many people, I guess, was very much worksheet dominated. I mean, you came in with worksheets. Mm-hmm. That was the standard way of managing and structuring a lesson, a short introduction and then a worksheet. And when I look back on some of the materials from that period now, I do cringe because it wasn't good. And you kind of, you compensated for the sterility of that approach by actually interacting a lot with individual pupils and developing a dialogue with them about what they were doing. But over time, I tried to move away from that sort of approach to something that was much more genuinely investigative, much more focused, much more focused on developing particular skills and understandings.
Is that because you were influenced by Schools History Council project, or was there?
I was influenced by SHP from the start, and in fact, the school that I worked in Wakefield, the head of department who had helped to appoint me, but who then promptly left and had gone by the time I took up my post in the school, actually left in order to become a member of the original Schools Council History Project team, which was based at Leeds, very close to Wakefield. So there was a link, you know, at that early stage. We weren't a pilot school, though. And actually, neither the school in Wakefield nor the school at which I worked in Norfolk did we take up the Schools Council History Project course until a couple of years before GCSE was introduced. And part of the reason for doing it at that point was that you could do a CSE and a O-level Schools Council History Project course, or Schools History Project course, as it had become, and teach them alongside each other. So you could have combined groups. You didn't have to select for O-level CSE classes at the age of 14, which was a huge advantage. Also, it was very clear that that sort of approach foreshadowed GCSE, so it was a, you know, it made sense strategically to do that at the time. But the fact that we didn't actually teach the course didn't mean that it wasn't a huge influence. And I mean, my own stance in relation to Schools Council History Project was, as it were, sort of critical supporter or supportive critic. I mean, there were elements of the philosophy and the methodology, especially as articulated brilliantly by Dennis Shemilt, with which I disagreed. I mean, the notion of history as a form of knowledge, as developed, was one with which you could take issue, and I did. But at the same time, in terms of approaches in the classroom, in terms of range of resources, in terms of range of subject matter, it was hugely influential. And our course in Norfolk had a What is History component. We used those materials. We taught the American West. We kind of used the project without necessarily buying into the whole course. And when I developed a Mode 3, I mean, that was in many ways reflective of a sort of an SHP type approach, but in some ways took it further, because it was a course that was based on the systematic use of local source material, documentary, visual, fieldwork, and so on. So it was like an extended history around us within a broad sort of social and economic history context. And that was what it seemed to make sense to teach in that school with those pupils at that time. And it was very successful. and it involved a lot of investment of time in developing the sources. So that in turn became a disincentive to moving away from it. But eventually we did, for all of those sort of long-term strategic reasons. I'm sorry, I'm being terribly prolix. You must shut me up. Cut in. Tell me to.
Why did you decide to become an advisor in 1985 and then an inspector in 1988?
I'd done Norwich Teacher Centre was actually an important influence on my professional life for quite a number of years. The second half of the time that I worked in Norfolk, particularly under really sort of talented, inspirational leadership of a coordinator who had a very broad vision of education and a wonderful way of supporting teachers, and I responded very strongly to that offered a course on using local historical resources at Norwich Teachers Centre with his encouragement. The Norfolk History Teachers Association, which I mentioned, met always at Norwich Teachers Centre. That was its spiritual home. And through that, it was, I suppose, a process of becoming interested in a broader view of history education, teaching and learning of history. Also through the GCSE training, that was a process that sort of took you out of your own school and led to engagement with other history departments, history teachers. And I found that I thoroughly enjoyed that. It was also a way of having influence. You could feel that you could make a difference, to more than just the youngsters in your own school, important, crucially important as they were. It was nice to sort of feel that you could have a wider influence. And also it was a creative process as well. There was, more scope for creativity as an advisor. I remember actually in 1987-88 when I was a history advisor in a purer sense really than I ever was before or subsequently, just one day stopping the car at a lay-by between two visits to schools and just thinking, what a lucky bugger I am, who could possibly have a better job than this? And it really, it really felt like that. It was just wonderful being able to be sort of evangelical about history education across a whole county,
You never had any resistant teachers?
I wouldn't say any outright resistance, no. Some were more enthusiastic than others. One or two people in secondary schools, when I visited them, because I made a point of visiting every secondary school history department, and often observed some lessons and had some discussions and so on. And one or two people said, "Why are you doing this? Why are you here?" And I suppose the answer was to kind of promote dialogue, to maybe challenge them. Perhaps I didn't quite put it that way, but in some cases that was the case, to make suggestions, to say, well, why don't you go and look at this? And, have you looked at those resources? And, do you know that they've got wonderful stuff at this site that you could visit? And that sort of thing. It was evangelism. You could really get a buzz from it. And ultimately people seemed happy with it as well. People didn't really resist it very much.
I suppose I'm contrasting it maybe with your later Ofsted role. It's completely different.
Well, it was different because it was all to do with dissemination. Very much to do with dissemination of everything good that there was, And it was to do with being creative and sort of trying to think of better ways of doing things, better ideas for history teaching. One of the things that we did in the Norfolk History Teachers Association was arrange with a tour operator to take the heads of history from Norfolk for free on a sort of reconnaissance tour of the battlefields of Belgium. And that was just lovely to do, because it was the bonding involved in sort of taking people away for a couple of nights, you know, a couple of nights in a hotel in Kortrijk or somewhere like that, and then visiting together these battlefields, and all on the basis that, you know, at least a proportion of the people would then probably book with that company, as indeed happened, you know. In fact, my own school was one that that did that, had already done it actually at the point where they but it was partly on that basis that we were able to persuade that company to do it as a promotion. And, you know, and it was a free weekend for Norfolk history teachers, and history teachers don't get many perks, you know, so that just felt like a really nice perk for a lot of people. So, yes, it was that kind of dissemination and evangelism, and being an HMI is not about evangelism. That's the real difference. I mean, you could still be about dissemination of good practice, and was, and is to this day, you know. I mean, HMI can and will refer to good practice that they've seen elsewhere as a way of sort of encouraging its you know, other schools to take it up and to emulate it, but it's not about promotion of a subject or a particular methodology or a particular philosophy. It's more detached, has to be. It's more objective, and ultimately it has a harder cutting edge. Now, that's not to say that the work of local authority advisors, inspectors, at the time that I was one and subsequently, doesn't have a cutting edge. I mean, but within HMI as a national organisation, within Ofsted subsequently, the fact that you have that sort of national consistency gives force, I guess, to the, you know, to the harder edge. I mean, it is judgmental. It's very important that it's judgmental, and it's very important that the judgments are consistent. There's no room really for, in that sense, or there's less room for particular enthusiasms. So it's a change of tone, you know, but not a total difference, I would say.
Thank you. Can we move on to the History Task Group? How did you come to be invited to join the National Curriculum Council in 1990 as a member of the HTG?
I'm honestly not sure. I think it was well, firstly, not all local authorities had inspectors with specific responsibility for history. Secondly, I had been an active member of the National Association of Advisors in History, which is where you would look, I guess, to recruit people. I'd been involved in GCSE training, and had got to know Nick Tate in the first instance through that, because Nick Tate was a chief examiner for what was then called LEAG, the London and East Anglian Examining Group, it was LEAG that in a sense was the local examining group in East Anglia and Norfolk at the time we were doing GCSE training, and most of the Norfolk secondary schools used LEAG syllabuses. So I first got to know Nick and Scott Harrison at that time. So there was a bit of history with Nick, I suppose, which possibly mattered. I'd invited him to Staffordshire as well, I think, as a chief examiner to talk. So we sort of, there was some sort of contact. I don't know. Beyond that, I couldn't say.
What was the brief of the HTG?
Right, now, that's an interesting question. I had to look back at all of those papers, really, to remind myself about this. Its brief, broadly, was to make the proposals for national curriculum history workable. The formal brief was to manage the sort of respond to the formal consultation on the Secretary of State's proposals for national curriculum history. So the process was that the Secretary of State set up these working groups. The working group produced an interim report, then it produced a final report. There was a huge debate going on all the time, as the press cuttings in there make clear. The final report received mixed reactions. There was quite a lot of support for it on the basis that it was a, you know, judicious compromise. Commander Saunders Watson kind of emerges as quite an astute operator, a man of unimpeachable independence, but a man who, it transpired, had quite a sort of fine sense of, you know, the controversial nature of what the working group was seeking to do and the different kind of forces at play. So the debate was going on. The Secretary of State clearly, I mean, must have been mindful of the degree of sort of consensus and support that the History Working Group's report sort of generated and reflected. But there was also a lot of criticism, mainly on the grounds that it was too heavy. It was overloaded. I remember there was a piece by Ted Ragg. I don't think I've got the cutting there, but there was a piece by Ted Ragg on the back of the Times Educational Supplement. And he used to write this irreverent and actually at times utterly exasperating column on the back of the TES. There was one that followed the publication of the final report of the History Working Group saying that what he really suggested that schools do was to roll up the report, get as many copies of the report as they could, roll them up and assemble them into a super gun. Now, this was Iraq. It was the time of the first Gulf War, wasn't it? The period leading up to the first Gulf War. And there was this discovery that the Iraqis were trying to manufacture a super gun to sort of lob shells at Israel. So Ted Ragg's suggestion was the History Working Group's report could be made into a super gun to sort of lob invective in the direction of the Secretary of State and the DES. I mean, it was typical Ted Ragg, as I say. I mean, he could be exasperating at times because he kind of missed the really important virtues of the report. But it's true that the Secretary of State was aware that there was a sort of groundswell of feeling that this was just too big and too heavy. And there was reaction from schools, from the unions and so on. So part of the brief for the History Task Group was to find ways of making it workable. And the Secretary of State, who by that time was John McGregor rather than Kenneth Baker, gave steers to the National Curriculum Council, which were mediated very skillfully, I now realise, looking at the papers again, by Nick Tate, into a brief for the task group. So what we worked on was firstly a way of reformulating the history study units so that they didn't appear so heavy, but at the same time so that they still appeared to be emphasizing historical knowledge. because part of the debate was, you know, the debate with the Sheila Lawler sort of tendency, the conservative right, that history had been taken over by trendy teachers who were only interested in skills and concepts, and children were leaving school not knowing the date of the Battle of Trafalgar. So knowledge had to be taught, and the steer for us all the time was to be, you know, very clear that there was important knowledge. But of course, the more you simplify specification of historical knowledge, the more arbitrary it becomes. And that was a problem that we, you know, wrestled with constantly. We also had to, well, it felt like sort out the attainment targets and the statements of attainment. John McGregor had asked that of the original four proposed attainment targets from the History Working Group, attainment target four, which was communication, should be dropped and somehow absorbed into the other three attainment targets. There was also a feeling, I think, that the statements of attainment as originally articulated were sort of much too vague and would not provide a sufficiently clear basis for reflecting progression in the learning of history. So we did an enormous amount of work on the reorganisation of the attainment targets. We were also asked to give more weight to attainment target one, which was the sort of knowledge and understanding attainment target. And then articulating statements of attainment that were clear, concise, but not impossibly reductive. And that wasn't difficult to do. That wasn't easy to do either. Very difficult task. And a lot of the papers that I retain, which are not included there, were all about sort of trying to map out different versions of attainment targets and statements of attainment. A part of that larger debate, which I particularly remembered because I felt very strongly about it, concerned what became known as Strand C of Attainment Target 1. Now, Attainment Target 1 had a strand that was to do with change and a strand that was to do with causation. And then a third strand, which was to do with understanding the nature of past societies. Attainment Target 2 was historical interpretations, understanding their nature, and I mean, huge contribution by the original History Working Group, one has to say. I mean, Attainment Target 2 was their creation, and very worthy creation. Attainment Target 3 was evidence and the skills involved in using and evaluating evidence. All of them were contentious in different ways and different reasons. My own particular issue arose when it was suggested, I think by Nick Tate, that Attainment Target 1 should only cover causation and change, and that this component that was concerned with the understanding of the nature of past societies should be dropped. And that may have been partly because it was there were sort of connotations in there of empathy. And empathy had become controversial. There was a huge debate. I mean, everybody's forgotten it now, but at the time, you know, in the late 80s, in the period leading up to the national curriculum, there was a huge debate about empathy in history. And the school's history project had promoted empathy and had done a lot of work in specifying levels of understanding, of empathetic understanding. So I think that was part of the reason, possibly, why there was a feeling that that strand should go. I was totally opposed to that. It seemed to me that it was the very soul of history, understanding the nature of past societies. And if you reduced history to simply, you know, understanding change and causation over time, you lost that essential component of it. So we had a huge debate and a bit of a row about it. And in the end, it stayed in. And it's there, you know, in the final order and in the recommendations, that strand. So that's a sharp personal memory. A lot of the other debates, you know, I struggle to remember the detail now, but that one really... was sort of sharply focused at the time.
And in terms of who supported what, did Nick Tate support your view then?
No, it
was kept in even though the chair...
It was, yes, as it was in the end. But then, I mean, Nick was very skillful... Now, what was his, how would you characterise his role? He didn't chair the group, that was Jennifer Whisker, but he serviced the group, he drove the group, he briefed the group, he set the agenda for the group, and he was very focused, and I think he was very skillful in understanding the political pressures and understanding how much give there was in any given situation. But he also listened, and he wanted to hear what people thought, there was a kind of an openness to argument as well.
So on this occasion, more people thought you should keep the attainment target with that wider perspective in, and so he went with the majority.
I don't know if it was simply going with the majority or being persuaded. I'd like to think it was the latter. To be honest, it's a long time ago, and I wouldn't rely on my memory on, you know, exactly why it was that it ended up that way. I just remember feeling hugely pleased that it had stayed in, because it had been imperiled at one stage.
You referred there to the political pressures. To what extent was the HTG affected by those political pressures surrounding the history?
Enormously, actually. It was quite an education for a sort of, you know, naive county inspector, you know, to go into that highly politicised environment. Having said that, there was space within which you could work. I mean, it wasn't that we were totally driven by political priorities, but at the time, and again, reading the papers now, it's very clear that the ministerial view carried huge weight, as you would expect, I guess. John McGregor had a view of what he wanted. So outrageously did Kenneth Clark at a later stage, when he decreed that any events that had taken place within the last 25 years were not history but current affairs. I think it was 25 years, or was it 20? For someone who by that stage had been teaching modern world history within a school's history project context, teaching about the Arab-Israeli conflict, getting youngsters to keep diaries of press cuttings of the conflict between Israel and the Arab states, and particularly the conflict in Lebanon, which was live at the time we were teaching it. And through keeping those diaries and through understanding the different factions in Lebanon, actually coming to a much wider historical understanding of how that situation had come to be as it was, in a kind of life-changing way. I don't think any of those youngsters will have forgotten that. And then to be told that everything that had happened in the last 25 years wasn't history was just outrageous. You know, the sense of disbelief and anger that ministerial intervention evoked.
In the group, you mean?
This actually happened right at the end of the group's work. I mean, I can't remember when the change of minister happened, but most of the group's work was done under the auspices of John McGregor as minister, and John McGregor was a much more emollient figure, much less creative than Kenneth Baker. I mean, Kenneth Baker had a vision. I don't think John McGregor had a vision. He just wanted things to run smoothly and you know, wanted to resolve the difficulties. But no, at a later stage, there was outrage actually at Kenneth Clark's view of modern history. It was politicised in other ways. I mean, the ministerial steers were hugely important and really provided the agenda for the group, the brief for the group. But there were also particular things. For example, I remember at one point we were told that when sort of whittling down the essential knowledge to be specified essential factual information to be specified within particular history study units, when we were working on the one that became known, I think, as the era of World War II, we had to include the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Holocaust had to be there. Now, I mean, you know, it's certainly a very strong case that the Holocaust has to be there, on purely historical grounds, but actually on contingent political grounds, the Holocaust had to be there.
So the civil servants told you that?
Yes. Yes. The role of Jane Baker and you know, as the person from the department, was, I suspect, more influential than I realised at the time. I mean, having subsequently, you know, worked a lot with people in the department, I can understand now, I think, more Jane's role than I did at the time. Nick also articulated these sort of political imperatives. You know, we've got to have that in, we've got to have that in. But having said that, as I said, you know, there was still a lot of space, and we were aware of, you know, Sheila Lawler sounding off. We were aware of Stuart Ducher, who became the sort of mouthpiece of the, you know, the Daily Mail tendency. We were aware of what people were saying, but I don't think we were driven by what people were saying. But we certainly were driven by what the minister said and what MPs said, or what became a political imperative, because it mattered a lot to particular MPs whom the government wanted to keep on board, I think. It's a really fascinating process, actually, and you know, it'd be lovely to relive it, because you know, at the time it was quite new.
Were you aware who these MPs were that were interested?
Well, the Holocaust, I think it was Grenville Janner, wasn't it, who asked questions in the House of Commons on more than one occasion about whether the Holocaust was included or not. And I mean, certainly the message that came through to us was that at all costs the Holocaust must be there, and we weren't disposed to disagree with that at all. I mean, as I say, you know, on historical grounds you can make that case very strongly. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I can't remember who it was who thought that was important, but
you mentioned Nick Tate. I did think he was chair of the HTG. What did his role have a title?
He was professional officer for history at the National Curriculum Council. And so he serviced the group. Mm-hmm. But the group had a, as it were, an independent chair, who was Jennifer Whisker, as I said.
You mentioned, you know, the political role of Nick in translating what ministers wanted. Did he also translate back what you wanted to ministers, or were you not aware of that?
He wouldn't have done that directly. I mean, that would have been sort of via Duncan Graham, and through Duncan Graham's communications, along with his opposite number at SEAC, with civil servants in the DES and ministers' advisors and so on. I mean, it would have been, you know, that kind of level. I mean, so Duncan Graham was an important figure, and I mean, Duncan Graham actually is a historian. I remember one amusing moment when Duncan visited. I think it was the secondary subgroup, and you know, he seemed very pleased with what we were doing and so on. And he said, "Oh well, if you get stuck, you can always call on other historians within the organisation." And Nick said, "No, Duncan, I don't think we'll have to go to those lengths." Nick commanded Duncan's confidence. That was very clear, I think. And the work that the task group did, it's clear from some of the correspondence that you'll find in the file, was very well regarded within NCC. And I mean, Duncan Graham is on the record as being very flattering about Nick's work and the work of the task group in the book that you were referring to. So I think, you know, we got it right. But you ask a question later on about, you know, why then was it so much revised subsequently? Well, we got it as right as we could in the context in which we were working, but the context changes. And I mean, it was a curious time, and it's all Kenneth Baker's fault, really, to have created a national curriculum specified in terms of subjects, and then to set up working groups subject by subject to make proposals for the subject. It sort of generated this huge kind of subject expansionism in subject after subject. So every subject was seeking to kind of take over the curriculum almost at that time. I mean, it was a heady period. And I mean, there was a time where history was seen as being very, very sort of prominent part of the national curriculum. I mean, it was said that Kenneth Baker had considered whether history should be a core subject alongside English, maths, and science. And certainly, with the sort of momentum that came from the process of developing, specifying national curriculum history and all the publicity and debate that accompanied that, there was a sense of being on the crest of a wave. And it comes through actually in the inset material, which, you know, is more ambitious than one would have dared to be subsequently. But then inevitably the point, you know, arrives where, you know, the quart won't go into the pint pot. That was the phrase that was constantly, I mean, I'm sure you remember those, you know, that point being made in those terms endlessly. And over time, you know, it told, and you had the Deering review and the whittling down of the national curriculum to make it manageable. So, you know, because of changes in that larger context, clearly what was produced at that particular time by the history task group was going to have to be revised and adapted, made more flexible, you know, reduced in weight and so on, which, as you say, has happened three times with the most recent revision. Yes.
Let's go back to the, you know, when this curriculum was ready. How many months did it take you to produce it? Not that long, was it?
Well, it was within a year. Mm-hmm. It all happened within a year. and a lot of work was done. I was seconded to NCC for 2 days a week for a couple of months towards the end of the work, partly to, you know, to work on some of the detail of that. And, you know, other people were sort of drawn in as well. The production of non-statutory guidance was another part of the brief of the history task group, and that really, you know, received more emphasis really when we'd done the sort of the structural work that had to be done on the order for history.
So what was your opinion about the final form of the History National Curriculum at the time as opposed to now?
That it was as good as could have been achieved in the circumstances.
And you thought it was going to work well for schools?
Yes, and the you'll see from the Staffordshire Inset material, there was a huge amount of enthusiasm about it at the time. I mean, we were determined to make it work and make it work well, make it a driver of good history. So in Staffordshire, for example, we had four part-time advisory teachers for history. I mean, a number that had never been achieved before and has never been achieved since. It was a crest of a wave, you know, with the implementation of the national curriculum and all of the resources that supported that, it was possible to do these things. So Staffordshire was divided into eight districts, big local authority, included Stoke-on-Trent at that time. And within each of those eight districts, we had a secondary history group and a primary history group. And the primary history groups were development groups. Each group took a different history study unit and developed a teaching plan and materials for it. And then we shared it around. So, and a lot of the people who were involved in that became real enthusiasts for it. There were people in primary schools who'd sort of were interested in history, but it, you know, that had never kind of really been harnessed, and now it was, and they had a an outlet, and they could be creative, they could be influential, they could, you know, develop their careers and play a part beyond their own schools. So, you know, a lot of people got a lot of excitement and a lot of commitment out of it, but then that passed, you know, that was the implementation phase. And once it sort of settled down, I have to say, and maybe it reflects the fact that I started to look at it as an HMI rather than as an evangelist, you know, it's all too often started to look terribly mechanical and boring, and, you know, people were using worksheets and little exercises on particular statements of attainment, and, you know, there was a sense sometimes of a kind of sterility setting in, and the thing becoming bureaucratic in a way that it was never intended to be, and we had never wanted it to be, you know. But things acquire their own momentum, and I suppose one has to say that not Ofsted itself, but the perceptions of Ofsted's role perhaps contributed to a feeling in schools that the national curriculum as specified had to be taught by numbers, you know, you had to teach it exactly as set down. I don't know.
That's interesting, because obviously you were visiting a lot of schools, firstly as an LEA inspector and then from 1992 as an HMI. So was it really by the early 90s that you were noticing that sterility, or a bit later on? And in what?
No, it was in the early 90s, because I didn't see a lot of history after, after 1993. So it was the early 90s, and then spasmodically subsequently.
Do you think it was more in primary or secondary where you were seeing that, doing it by numbers, as you say?
I think it was both, actually. Particularly secondary. I don't know, I think I have to be careful here because my own role changed and you know, when I was working in Staffordshire and the whole focus of one's work was to make national curriculum history something exciting and vibrant and successful. Sometimes that affects your perceptions of what you're seeing. You know, you see the glass half full. With a more sort of cold, objective view, maybe you see it half empty to a degree. So I don't quite trust my own perceptions there. I mean, my own position had changed as well. But I think it's true that a lot of the enthusiasm and the sort of pioneering zeal that I think there definitely was around, certainly in Staffordshire, around the implementation of national curriculum history, I think a lot of that ebbed away in many schools. I mean, not all, and there's always been good history happening in schools, and one always, you know, it's one of the nice things about history it's often one of the leading subjects, even in schools and special measures. You can see good history. The Schools History Project has continued to be influential, and I don't want to sort of over egg the pudding, but I do think there was a sort of, there was a crest of the wave, and then there was a bit of a falling away afterwards, and history once again seemed to go on to the defensive. Whereas in that expansionary period of implementation of national curriculum, it really felt that history's influence was expanding.
Do you think it was partly because getting to grips with the national curriculum was still terrifically demanding for schools, for history? Because there were lots of complaints that it still was overloaded.
Yes. Yeah. Arguably. I don't know, it never seemed to us at the time that it was terribly demanding, but then, you know, when you're in the middle of it and feel some ownership of it, perhaps you're not going to feel that it's very demanding.
Is there another explanation for why schools' enthusiasm dwindled over time?
Yeah, it's interesting that. I mean, I can remember in 1987 having a conversation with somebody, and at that time, it's before the Education Reform Act of 1988, which introduced the national curriculum, introduced the process of defining the national curriculum. But the Education Reform Act didn't come out of the blue, and the notion of there being a national curriculum had been developing for some time, really from Ruskin, Callaghan's Ruskin speech onwards, I guess.